concerted campaign to take his life in the name of God. Sheltered as my own life normally is, I had a taste of this surreal situation when Mr. Rushdie came to Washington over the Thanksgiving weekend of 1993 in order to keep an appointment with President Clinton, and stayed for a night or two in my apartment. An enormous and forbidding security operation was necessary to bring this about, and when the visit was over, I was asked to pay a visit to the Department of State. There I was informed by a senior official that believable chatter had been intercepted, expressing the intention of revenge on me and on my family. I was advised to change my address and my telephone number, which seemed an unlikely way of avoiding reprisal. However, it did put me on notice of what I already knew. It is not possible for me to say, well, you pursue your Shiite dream of a hidden imam, and I pursue my study of Thomas Paine and George Orwell, and the world is big enough for both of us. The true believer cannot rest until the whole world bows the knee. Is it not obvious to all, say the pious, that religious authority is paramount, and that those who decline to recognize it have forfeited their right to exist? It was, as it happens, the murderers of the Shia who forced this point upon the world's attention a few years later. So ghastly had been the regime of the Taliban in Afghanistan, which slaughtered the Shiite Hazara population, that Iran itself had considered invading the country in 1999. And so great was the Taliban's addiction to profanity that it had methodically shelled and destroyed one of the world's greatest cultural artifacts, the twin Buddha statues at Bamiyan, which in their magnificence showed the fusion of Hellenic and other styles in the Afghan past. But, pre-Islamic as they undoubtedly were, the statues were a standing insult to the Taliban and their Al-Qaeda guests. And the reduction of Bamiyan to shards and rubble foreshadowed the incineration of two other twin structures, as well as almost 3,000 human beings, in downtown Manhattan in the fall of 2001. Everybody has their own 9/11 story. I shall skip over mine, except to say that someone I slightly knew was flown into the wall of the Pentagon, having managed to call her husband and give a description of her murderers and their tactics, and having learned from him that it was not a hijack and that she was going to die. From the roof of my building in Washington, I could see the smoke rising from the other side of the river, and I've never since passed the Capitol or the White House without thinking of what might have happened were it not for the courage and resourcefulness of the passengers on the fourth plane, who managed to bring it down in a Pennsylvanian field, only 20 minutes flying time from its destination. Well, I was able to write in a further reply to Dennis Prager, now you have your answer. The 19 suicide murderers of New York and Washington and Pennsylvania were beyond any doubt the most sincere believers on those planes. Perhaps we can hear a little less about how people of faith possess moral advantages that others can only envy. And what is to be learned from the jubilation and the ecstatic propaganda with which this great feat of fidelity has been greeted in the Islamic world? At the time, the United States had an attorney general named John Ashcroft, who had stated that America had no king but Jesus, a claim that was exactly two words too long. It had a president who wanted to hand over the care of the poor to faith-based institutions. Might this not be a moment where the light of reason and the defense of a society that separated church and state and valued free expression and free inquiry be granted a point or two? The disappointment was, and to me remains, acute. Within hours, the Reverends Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell had announced that the immolation of their fellow creatures was a divine judgment on a secular society that tolerated homosexuality and abortion. At the solemn memorial service for the victims held in the beautiful National Cathedral in Washington, an address was permitted from Billy Graham, a man whose record of opportunism and anti-Semitism is in itself a minor national disgrace. His absurd sermon made the claim that all the dead were now in paradise and would not return to us even if they could. I say absurd because it's impossible, even in the most lenient terms, to believe that a good number of sinful citizens had not been murdered by Al-Qaeda that day. And there is no reason to believe that Billy Graham knew the current whereabouts of their souls, let alone of their posthumous desires. But there was also something sinister in hearing detailed claims to knowledge of paradise, of the sort that Bin Laden himself was making on behalf of the assassins. Matters continued to deteriorate in the interval between the removal of the Taliban and the overthrow of Saddam Hussein. A senior military official named General William Boykin announced that he had been vouchsafed a vision while serving earlier during the fiasco in Somalia. Apparently, The face of Satan himself had been detected by some aerial photography of Mogadishu, but this had only increased the confidence of the general that his god was stronger than the evil deity of the opposition. At the U.S. Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs, it was revealed that Jewish and agnostic cadets were being viciously bullied by a group of unpunished, born-again cadres, who insisted that only those accepting Jesus as a personal savior were qualified to serve. The deputy commander of the academy sent out emails proselytizing for a national day of Christian prayer. A chaplain named Melinda Morton, who complained about this hysteria and intimidation, was abruptly transferred to a faraway base in Japan. Meanwhile, empty-headed multiculturalism also contributed its portion by, among other means, ensuring the distribution of cheap and mass-produced Saudi editions of the Quran for use in America's prison system. These Wahhabi texts went even further than the original in recommending holy war against all Christians and Jews and secularists. To observe all this was to witness a kind of cultural suicide, an assisted suicide, at which believers and unbelievers were both prepared to officiate. It ought to have been pointed out at once that this sort of thing, as well as being unethical and unprofessional, was also flat-out unconstitutional and anti-American. James Madison, the author of the First Amendment to the Constitution, prohibiting any law respecting an establishment of religion, was also an author of Article 6, which states unambiguously that no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust. His later detached memoranda make it very plain that he opposed the government appointment of chaplains in the first place, either in the armed forces or at the opening ceremonies of Congress. The establishment of the chaplainship to Congress is a palpable violation of equal rights, as well as of constitutional principles. As to clerical presence in the armed forces, Madison wrote, "The object of this establishment is seducing. The motive to it is laudable. But is it not safer to adhere to a right principle and trust to its consequences, than confide in the reasoning, however specious, in favour of a wrong one? Look through the armies and navies of the world and say, whether in the appointment of their ministers of religion, the spiritual interest of the flocks or the temporal interest of the shepherd be most in view." Anyone citing Madison today would very likely be thought either subversive or insane, and yet without him and Thomas Jefferson, co-authors of the Virginia Statute on Religious Freedom, the United States would have gone on as it was, with Jews prohibited from holding office in some states, Catholics in others, and Protestants in Maryland, the latter a state where profane words concerning the Holy Trinity were punishable by torture, branding, and, at the third offense, death without benefit of clergy. Georgia might have persisted in maintaining that its official state faith was Protestantism, whichever one of Luther's many hybrids that might have turned out to be. As the debate over intervention in Iraq became more heated, positive torrents of nonsense poured from the pulpits. Most churches opposed the effort to remove Saddam Hussein, and the Pope disgraced himself utterly by issuing a personal invitation to the wanted war criminal Tariq Aziz, a man responsible for the state murder of children. Not only was Aziz welcomed at the Vatican as the senior Catholic member of a ruling fascist party, not the first time that such an indulgence had been granted, he was then taken to Assisi for a personal session of prayer at the shrine of St. Francis, who apparently used to lecture to birds. This, he must have thought, was altogether too easy. On the other side of the confessional span, some but not all American evangelicals thundered joyously about the prospect of winning the Muslim world for Jesus. I say some but not all because one fundamentalist splinter group has since taken to picketing the funerals of American soldiers killed in Iraq, claiming that their murders are God's punishment for American homosexuality. One especially tasteful sign, waved in the faces of the mourners, is, "Thank God for IEDs, the roadside bombs placed by equally anti-gay Muslim fascists." It is not my problem to decide which theology is the correct one here. I would say the chances of either being right are approximately the same. Charles Stanley, whose weekly sermons from the First Baptist Church in Atlanta are watched by millions, could have been any demagogic imam, as he said, "We should offer to serve the war effort in any way possible. God battles with people who oppose him, who fight against him and his followers." His organization's Baptist Press News Service printed an article from a missionary, exulting that American foreign policy and military might have opened an opportunity for the gospel in the land of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Never to be outdone, Tim LaHaye decided to go even further. Best known as the co-author of the best-selling Left Behind pulp novel series, which readies the average American for the rapture and then for Armageddon, he spoke of Iraq as a focal point of end-time events. Other biblical enthusiasts tried to link Saddam Hussein with the wicked king Nebuchadnezzar of ancient Babylon, a comparison that the dictator himself would probably have approved, given his rebuilding of the old walls at Babylon with bricks that had his name inscribed on every one of them. Thus, instead of a rational discussion about the best way to contain and defeat religious fanaticism, one had the mutual reinforcement of two forms of that mania. The jihadist assault re-conjured the blood-stained spectre of the Crusaders. In this respect, religion is not unlike racism. One version of it inspires and provokes the other. I was once asked another trick question, slightly more searching than Dennis Prager's, that was designed to uncover my level of latent prejudice. You are on a subway platform in New York, late at night, in a deserted station. Suddenly, a group of a dozen black men appears. Do you stay where you are, or move to the exit? I was able again to reply that I had had this exact experience. Waiting alone for a train well after midnight, I had been suddenly joined by a crew of repairmen exiting the tunnel with their tools and work gloves. All of them were black. I felt instantly safer and moved toward them. I have no idea what their religious affiliation was. But in every other case that I've cited, religion has been an enormous multiplier of tribal suspicion and hatred, with members of each group talking of the other in precisely the tones of the bigot. The Christians and Jews eat defiled pig meat and swill poisonous alcohol. Buddhist and Muslim Sri Lankans blamed the wine-oriented Christmas celebrations of 2004 for the immediately following tsunami. Catholics are dirty and have too many children. Muslims breed like rabbits and wipe their bottoms with the wrong hand. Jews have lice in their beards and seek the blood of Christian children to add flavor and zest to their Passover matzos. And so it goes on. Chapter 3. A Short Digression on the Pig, or Why Heaven Hates Ham. All religions have a tendency to feature some dietary injunction or prohibition, whether it is the now-lapsed Catholic injunction to eat fish on Fridays, or the adoration by Hindus of the cow as a consecrated and invulnerable animal. The government of India even offered to import and protect all the cattle facing slaughter as a result of the bovine encephalitic or mad cow plague that swept Europe in the 1990s, or the refusal by some other Eastern cults to consume any animal flesh, or to injure any other creature, be it rat or flea. But the oldest and most tenacious of all fetishes is the hatred and even fear of the pig. It emerged in primitive Judea and was for centuries one of the ways, the other being circumcision, by which Jews could be distinguished. Even though Surah 5, verse 60, of the Quran condemns particularly Jews, but also other unbelievers, as having been turned into pigs and monkeys, a very intense theme in recent Salafist Muslim preaching, and the Quran describes the flesh of swine as unclean or even abominable, Muslims appear to see nothing ironic in the adoption of this uniquely Jewish taboo. Real horror of the porcine is manifest all over the Islamic world. One good instance would be the continued prohibition of George Orwell's Animal Farm, one of the most charming and useful fables of modern times, of the reading of which Muslim schoolchildren are deprived. I've perused some of the solemn prohibition orders written by Arab education ministries, which are so stupid that they fail to notice the evil and dictatorial role played by the pigs in the story itself. Orwell actually did dislike pigs as a consequence of his failure as a small farmer, and this revulsion is shared by many adults who have had to work with these difficult animals in agricultural conditions. Crammed together in sties, pigs tend to act swinishly, as it were, and to have noisy and nasty fights. It's not unknown for them to eat their own young and even their own excrement, while their tendency to random and loose gallantry is often painful to the more fastidious eye. But it has often been noticed that pigs, left to their own devices, and granted sufficient space, will keep themselves very clean, arrange little bowers, bring up families, and engage in social interaction with other pigs. The creatures also display many signs of intelligence, and it has been calculated that the crucial ratio between brain weight and body weight is almost as high with them as it is in dolphins. There is great adaptability between the pig and its environment, as witness wild boars and feral pigs, as opposed to the placid porkers and frisky piglets of our more immediate experience. But the cloven hoof, or trotter, became a sign of diabolism to the fearful, and I dare say that it is easy to surmise which came first, the devil or the pig. It would be merely boring and idiotic to wonder how the designer of all things conceived such a versatile creature, and then commanded his higher mammal creation to avoid it altogether, or risk his eternal displeasure. But many otherwise intelligent mammals affect the belief that heaven hates ham. I hope that you have guessed by now what we know in any case, that this fine beast is one of our fairly close cousins. It shares a great deal of our DNA, and there have lately been welcome transplants of skin, heart valves, and kidneys from pigs to humans. If, which I heartily trust does not happen, a new Dr. Morrow could corrupt recent advances in cloning and create a hybrid, a pig man is widely feared as the most probable outcome. Meanwhile, almost everything about the pig is useful, from its nutritious and delicious meat to its tanned hide for leather and its bristles for brushes. In Upton Sinclair's graphic novel of the Chicago slaughterhouse, The Jungle, it is agonizing to read about the way that pigs are borne aloft on hooks, screaming as their throats are cut. Even the strongest nerves of the most hardened workers are shaken by the experience. There's something about that shriek. To press this a little further, one may note that children, if left unmolested by rabbis and imams, are very drawn to pigs, especially to baby ones, and that firefighters in general do not like to eat roast pork or crackling. The barbaric vernacular word for roasted human in New Guinea and elsewhere was long pig. I have never had the relevant degustative experience myself, but it seems that we do, if eaten, taste very much like pigs. This helps to make nonsense of the usual secular explanations of the original Jewish prohibition. It is argued that the ban was initially rational, since pig meat in hot climates can become rank and develop the worms of trichinosis. This objection, which perhaps does apply in the case of non-kosher shellfish, is absurd when applied to the actual conditions. First, trichinosis is found in all climates, and in fact occurs more in cold than in hot ones. Second, ancient Jewish settlements in the land of Canaan can easily be distinguished by archaeologists by the absence of pig bones in their rubbish tips, as opposed to the presence of such bones in the middens of other communities. The non-Jews did not sicken and die from eating pork, in other words. Quite apart from anything else, if they had died for this reason, there would have been no need for the God of Moses to urge their slaughter by non-pig eaters. There must therefore be another answer to the conundrum. I claim my own solution as original, though without the help of Sir James Fraser and the great Ibn Warraq, I might not have hit upon it. According to many ancient authorities, the attitude of early Semites to swine was one of reverence as much as disgust. The eating of pig flesh was considered as something special, even privileged and ritualistic. This mad confusion between the sacred and the profane is found in all faiths at all times. The simultaneous attraction and repulsion derived from an anthropomorphic root, the look of the pig, and the taste of the pig, and the dying yells of the pig, and the evident intelligence of the pig, were too uncomfortably reminiscent of the human. Porcophobia and porcophilia thus probably originate in a night time of human sacrifice and even cannibalism, at which the holy texts often do more than hint. Nothing optional, from homosexuality to adultery, is ever made punishable unless those who do the prohibiting and exact the fierce punishments have a repressed desire to participate. As Shakespeare put it in King Lear, the policeman who lashes the whore has a hot need to use her for the very offence for which he plies the lash. Porcophilia can also be used for oppressive and repressive purposes. In medieval Spain, where Jews and Muslims were compelled on pain of death and torture to convert to Christianity, the religious authorities quite rightly suspected that many of the conversions were not sincere. Indeed, the Inquisition arose partly from the holy dread that secret infidels were attending Mass, where, of course, and even more disgustingly, they were pretending to eat human flesh and drink human blood in the person of Christ himself. Among the customs that arose in consequence was the offering, at most events formal and informal, of a plate of charcuterie. Those who've been fortunate enough to visit Spain, or any good Spanish restaurant, will be familiar with the gesture of hospitality. Literally dozens of pieces of differently cured, differently sliced pig. But the grim origin of this lies in a constant effort to sniff out heresy and to be unsmilingly watchful for giveaway expressions of distaste. In the hands of eager Christian fanatics, even the toothsome jamón ibérico could be pressed into service as a form of torture. Today, ancient stupidity is upon us again. Muslim zealots in Europe are demanding that the Three Little Pigs and Miss Piggy, Winnie the Pooh's piglet, and other traditional pets and characters be removed from the innocent gaze of their children. The mirthless cretins of jihad have probably not read enough to know of the Empress of Blandings and of the Earl of Emsworth's infinitely renewable delight in the splendid pages of the incomparable author Mr. Whiffle, The Care of the Pig. But there will be trouble when they get that far. An old statue of a wild boar in an arboretum in Middle England has already been threatened with mindless Islamic vandalism. In microcosm, this apparently trivial fetish shows how religion and faith and superstition distort our whole picture of the world. The pig is so close to us and has been so handy to us in so many respects that a strong case is now made by humanists that it should not be factory farmed, confined, separated from its young, and forced to live in its own ordure. All other considerations to one side, the resulting pink and spongy meat is somewhat rebarbative. But this is a decision that we can make in the plain light of reason and compassion, as extended to fellow creatures and relatives, and not as a result of incantations from Iron Age campfires where much worse offences were celebrated in the name of God. "Pig's head on a stick," says the nervous but stout-hearted Ralph in the face of the buzzing, suppurating idol, first killed and then worshipped, that has been set up by cruel, frightened schoolboys in Lord of the Flies. "Pig's head on a stick." And he was more right than he could have known, and much wiser than his elders, as well as his delinquent juniors. Chapter 4. A note on health to which religion can be hazardous. In dark ages, people are best guided by religion. As in a pitch-black night, a blind man is the best guide. He knows the roads and paths better than a man who can see. When daylight comes, however, it is foolish to use blind old men as guides. Heinrich Heine, Gedanken und Einfalle. In the fall of 2001, I was in Calcutta with the magnificent photographer Sebastião Salgado, a Brazilian genius whose studies with the camera have made vivid the lives of migrants, war victims, and those workers who toil to extract primary products from mines and quarries and forests. On this occasion, he was acting as an envoy of UNICEF and promoting his cause as a crusader, in the positive sense of that term, against the scourge of polio. Thanks to the work of inspired and enlightened scientists like Jonas Salk, it is now possible to immunize children against this ghastly malady for a negligible cost. The few cents or pennies that it takes to administer 2 drops of oral vaccine to the mouth of an infant. Advances in medicine had managed to put the fear of smallpox behind us, and it was confidently expected that another year would do the same for polio. Humanity itself had seemingly united on this proposition. In several countries, including El Salvador, warring combatants had proclaimed ceasefires in order to allow the inoculation teams to move freely. Extremely poor and backward countries had mustered the resources to get the good news to every village. No more children need be killed or made useless and miserable by this hideous disease. Back home in Washington, where that year many people were still fearfully staying indoors after the trauma of 9/11, my youngest daughter was going dauntlessly door-to-door on Halloween, piping trick-or-treat for UNICEF, and healing or saving, with every fistful of small change, children she would never meet. One had that rare sense of participating in an entirely positive enterprise. The people of Bengal, and particularly the women, were enthusiastic and inventive. I remember one committee meeting where staunch Calcutta hostesses planned without embarrassment to team up with the city's prostitutes to spread the word into the farthest corners of society. Bring your children, no questions asked, and let them swallow the 2 drops of fluid. Someone knew of an elephant a few miles out of town that might be hired to lead a publicity parade. Everything was going well. In one of the poorest cities and states of the world, there was to be a new start. And then we began to hear of a rumour. In some outlying places, Muslim diehards were spreading the story that the droplets were a plot. If you took this sinister Western medicine, you would be stricken by impotence and diarrhea, a forbidding and depressing combination. This was a problem because the drops have to be administered twice, the second time as a booster and confirmation of immunity, and because it takes only a few uninoculated people to allow the disease to survive and revive and to spread back through contact in the water supply. As with smallpox, eradication must be utter and complete. I wondered, as I left Calcutta, if West Bengal would manage to meet the deadline and declare itself polio-free by the end of the next year. That would leave only pockets of Afghanistan and one or two other inaccessible regions already devastated by religious fervour before we could say that another ancient tyranny of illness had been decisively overthrown. In 2005, I learned of one outcome. In northern Nigeria, a country that had previously checked in as provisionally polio-free, a group of Islamic religious figures issued a ruling, or fatwa, that declared the polio vaccine to be a conspiracy by the United States and, amazingly, the United Nations against the Muslim faith. The drops were designed, said these mullahs, to sterilize the true believers. Their intention and effect was genocidal. Nobody was to swallow them or administer them to infants. Within months, polio was back, and not just in northern Nigeria. Nigerian travelers and pilgrims had already taken it as far as Mecca and spread it back to several other polio-free countries, including three African ones and also far away Yemen. The entire boulder would have to be rolled right back up to the top of the mountain. You may say that this is an isolated case, which would be a grimly apt way of putting it, but you would be mistaken. Would you care to see my video of the advice given by Cardinal Alfonso Lopez de Trujillo, the Vatican's president of the Pontifical Council for the Family, carefully warning his audience that all condoms are secretly made with many microscopic holes through which the AIDS virus can pass? Close your eyes and try to picture what you might say if you had the authority to inflict the greatest possible suffering in the least number of words. Consider the damage that such a dogma has caused. Presumably those holes permit the passage of other things too, which rather destroys the point of a condom in the first place. To make such a statement in Rome is wicked enough, but translate the message into the language of poor and stricken countries and see what happens. During carnival season in Brazil, the auxiliary Bishop of Rio de Janeiro, Rafael Jano Cifuentes, told his congregation in a sermon that the church is against condom use. Sexual relations between a man and a woman have to be natural. I have never seen a little dog using a condom during sexual intercourse with another dog. Senior clerical figures in several other countries, Cardinal Obando y Bravo of Nicaragua, the Archbishop of Nairobi in Kenya, Cardinal Emmanuel Romala of Uganda, have all told their flocks that condoms transmit AIDS. Cardinal Romala indeed has opined that women who die of AIDS, rather than employ latex protection, should be considered as martyrs, though presumably this martyrdom must take place within the confines of marriage. The Islamic authorities have been no better and sometimes worse. In 1995, the Council of Ulemas in Indonesia urged that condoms only be made available to married couples and on prescription. In Iran, a worker found to be HIV positive can lose his job, and doctors and hospitals have the right to refuse treatment to AIDS patients. An official of Pakistan's AIDS control program told Foreign Policy magazine in 2005 that the problem was smaller in his country because of better social and Islamic values. This in a state where the law allows a woman to be sentenced to be gang-raped in order to expiate the shame of a crime committed by her brother. This is the old religious combination of repression and denial. A plague like AIDS is assumed to be unmentionable because the teachings of the Quran are enough in themselves to inhibit premarital intercourse, drug use, adultery, and prostitution. Even a very brief visit to, say, Iran, will demonstrate the opposite. It is the mullahs themselves who profit from hypocrisy by licensing temporary marriages, in which wedding certificates are available for a few hours, sometimes in specially designated houses, with a divorce declaration ready to hand at the conclusion of business. You could almost call it prostitution. The last time I was offered such a bargain, it was just outside the ugly shrine to the Ayatollah Khomeini in South Tehran. But veiled and burqa-clad women, infected by their husbands with the virus, are expected to die in silence. It is a certainty that millions of other harmless and decent people will die, very miserably and quite needlessly, all over the world, as a result of this obscurantism. The attitude of religion to medicine, like the attitude of religion to science, is always necessarily problematic and very often necessarily hostile. A modern believer can say, and even believe, that his faith is quite compatible with science and medicine, but the awkward fact will always be that both things have a tendency to break religion's monopoly, and have often been fiercely resisted for that reason. What happens to the faith healer and the shaman when any poor citizen can see the full effect of drugs and surgeries administered without ceremonies or mystifications? Roughly the same thing as happens to the rainmaker when the climatologist turns up, or to the diviner from the heavens when schoolteachers get hold of elementary telescopes. Plagues of antiquity were held to be punishment from the gods, which did much to strengthen the hold of the priesthood and much to encourage the burning of infidels and heretics who were thought, in an alternative explanation, to be spreading disease by witchcraft or else poisoning the wells. We may make allowances for the orgies of stupidity and cruelty that were indulged in before humanity had a clear concept of the germ theory of disease. Most of the miracles of the New Testament have to do with healing, which was of such great importance in a time when even minor illness was often the end. Saint Augustine himself said that he would not have believed in Christianity if it were not for the miracles. Scientific critics of religion, such as Daniel Dennett, have been generous enough to point out that apparently useless healing rituals may even have helped people get better, in that we know how important morale can be in aiding the body to fight injury and infection. But that would be an excuse only available in retrospect. By the time Dr. Jenner had discovered that a cowpox vaccine could ward off smallpox, this excuse had become void. Yet Timothy Dwight, the president of Yale University, and to this day one of America's most respected divines, was opposed to the smallpox vaccination because he regarded it as an interference with God's design. And this mentality is still heavily present, long after its pretext and justification in human ignorance has vanished. It is interesting and suggestive that the Archbishop of Rio makes his analogy with dogs. They do not trouble to roll on a condom. Who are we to quarrel with their fidelity to nature? In the recent division in the Anglican Church over homosexuality and ordination, several bishops made the fatuous point that homosexuality is unnatural because it does not occur in other species. Leave aside the fundamental absurdity of this observation. Are humans part of nature or not? Or, if they chance to be homosexual, are they created in God's image or not? Leave aside the well-attested fact that numberless kinds of birds and mammals and primates do engage in homosexual play. Who are the clerics to interpret nature? They've shown themselves quite unable to do so. A condom is quite simply a necessary but not a sufficient condition for avoiding the transmission of AIDS. All qualified authorities, including those who state that abstinence is even better, are agreed on this. Homosexuality is present in all societies, and its incidence would appear to be part of human design. We must perforce confront these facts as we find them. We now know that the bubonic plague was spread not by sin or moral backsliding, but by rats and fleas. Archbishop Lancelot Andrews, during the celebrated Black Death in London in 1665, noticed uneasily that the horror fell upon those who prayed and kept the faith as well as upon those who did not. He came perilously close to stumbling upon a real point. As I was writing this chapter, an argument broke out in my hometown of Washington, D.C. The human papillomavirus, HPV, has long been known as a sexually transmitted infection that, at its worst, can cause cervical cancer in women. A vaccine is now available. These days, vaccines are increasingly swiftly developed, not to cure this malady, but to immunize women against it. But there are forces in the administration who oppose the adoption of this measure on the grounds that it fails to discourage premarital sex. To accept the spread of cervical cancer in the name of God is no different, morally or intellectually, from sacrificing these women on a stone altar and thanking the deity for giving us the sexual impulse and then condemning it. We do not know how many people in Africa have died or will die because of the AIDS virus, which was isolated and became treatable in a great feat of humane scientific research very soon after it made its lethal appearance. On the other hand, we do know that having sex with virgin, one of the more popular local cures, does not in fact prevent or banish the infection. And we also know that the use of condoms can at least contribute, as a form of prophylaxis, to the limitation and containment of the virus. We are not dealing, as early missionaries might have liked to believe, with witch doctors and savages who resist the boons that the missionaries bring. We are instead dealing with the Bush administration, which, in a supposedly secular republic in the 21st century, refuses to share its foreign aid budget with charities and clinics that offer advice on family planning. At least two major and established religions, with millions of adherents in Africa, believe that the cure is very much worse than the disease. They also harbour the belief that the AIDS plague is in some sense a verdict from heaven upon sexual deviance, in particular upon homosexuality. A single stroke of Occam's potent razor eviscerates this half-baked savagery. Female homosexuals not only do not contract AIDS, except if they are unlucky with a transfusion or a needle, they are also much freer of all venereal infection than even heterosexuals. Yet clerical authorities persistently refuse to be honest about even the existence of the lesbian. In doing so, they further demonstrate that religion continues to pose an urgent threat to public health. I pose a hypothetical question. As a man of some 57 years of age, I am discovered sucking the penis of a baby boy. I ask you to picture your own outrage and revulsion. Ah, but I have my explanation already. I am a moyle, an appointed circumciser and foreskin remover. My authority comes from an ancient text, which commands me to take a baby boy's penis in my hand, cut around the prepuce, and complete the action by taking his penis in my mouth, sucking off the foreskin, and spitting out the amputated flap, along with a mouthful of blood and saliva. This practice has been abandoned by most Jews, either because of its unhygienic nature or its disturbing associations, but it still persists among the sort of Hasidic fundamentalists who hope for the Second Temple to be rebuilt in Jerusalem. To them, the primitive rite of the Periah Mestitza is part of the original and unbreakable covenant with God. In New York City, in the year 2005, the ritual, as performed by a 57-year-old moyle, was found to have given genital herpes to several small boys and to have caused the deaths of at least two of them. In normal circumstances, the disclosure would have led the public health department to forbid the practice and the mayor to denounce it. But in the capital of the modern world, in the first decade of the 21st century, such was not the case. Instead, Mayor Bloomberg overrode the reports by distinguished Jewish physicians who had warned of the danger of the custom and told his healthcare bureaucracy to postpone any verdict. The crucial thing, he said, was to be sure that the free exercise of religion was not being infringed. In a public debate with Peter Steinfels, the liberal Catholic religion editor of the New York Times, I was told the same thing. It happened to be election year in New York for the mayor, which often explains a lot. But this pattern recurs in other denominations and other states and cities, as well as in other countries. Across a wide swath of animist and Muslim Africa, young girls are subjected to the hell of circumcision and infibulation, which involves the slicing off of the labia and the clitoris, often with a sharp stone, and then the stitching up of the vaginal opening with strong twine, not to be removed until it is broken by male force on the bridal night. Compassion and biology allow for a small aperture to be left, meanwhile, for the passage of menstrual blood. The resulting stench, pain, humiliation, and misery exceed anything that can be easily imagined and inevitably result in infection, sterility, shame, and the death of many women and babies in childbirth. No society would tolerate such an insult to its womanhood and therefore to its survival if the foul practice was not holy and sanctified. But then no New Yorker would permit atrocities against infants if not for the same consideration. Parents professing to believe the nonsensical claims of Christian Science have been accused, but not always convicted, of denying urgent medical care to their offspring. Parents who imagine themselves to be Jehovah's Witnesses have refused permission for their children to receive blood transfusions. Parents who imagine that a man named Joseph Smith was led to a set of buried golden tablets have married their underage Mormon daughters to favoured uncles and brothers-in-law, who sometimes have older wives already. The Shia fundamentalists in Iran lowered the age of consent to 9, perhaps in admiring emulation of the age of the youngest wife of the Prophet Muhammad. Hindu child brides in India are flogged and sometimes burned alive if the pathetic dowry they bring is judged to be too small. The Vatican and its vast network of dioceses has in the past decade alone been forced to admit complicity in a huge racket of child rape and child torture, mainly but by no means exclusively homosexual, in which known pederasts and sadists were shielded from the law and reassigned to parishes where the pickings of the innocent and the defenceless were often richer. In Ireland alone, once an unquestioning disciple of Holy Mother Church, it is now estimated that the unmolested children of religious schools were very probably the minority. Now, religion professes a special role in the protection and instruction of children. Woe to him, says the Grand Inquisitor in Dostoevsky's The Brothers Karamazov, who harms a child. The New Testament has Jesus informing us that one so guilty would be better off at the bottom of the sea and with a millstone around his neck at that. But both in theory and in practice, religion uses the innocent and the defenceless for the purposes of experiment. By all means, let an observant Jewish adult male have his raw-cut penis placed in the mouth of a rabbi. That would be legal, at least in New York. By all means, let grown women who distrust their clitoris or their labia have them sawn away by some other wretched adult female. By all means, let Abraham offer to commit suicide to prove his devotion to the Lord or his belief in the voices he was hearing in his head. By all means, let devout parents deny themselves the succor of medicine when in acute pain and distress. By all means, for all I care, let a priest sworn to celibacy be a promiscuous homosexual. By all means, let a congregation that believes in whipping out the devil choose a new grown-up sinner each week and lash him until he or she bleeds. By all means, let anyone who believes in creationism instruct his fellows during lunch breaks. But the conscription of the unprotected child for these purposes is something that even the most dedicated secularist can safely describe as a sin. I do not set myself up as a moral exemplar and would be swiftly knocked down if I did. But if I was suspected of raping a child, or torturing a child, or infecting a child with venereal disease, or selling a child into sexual or any other kind of slavery, I might consider committing suicide whether I was guilty or not. If I had actually committed the offence, I would welcome death in any form that it might take. This revulsion is innate in any healthy person and does not need to be taught. Since religion has proved itself uniquely delinquent on the one subject where moral and ethical authority might be counted as universal and absolute, I think we are entitled to at least 3 provisional conclusions. The first is that religion and the churches are manufactured and that this salient fact is too obvious to ignore. The second is that ethics and morality are quite independent of faith and cannot be derived from it. The third is that religion is, because it claims a special divine exemption for its practices and beliefs, not just amoral, but immoral. The ignorant psychopath or brute who mistreats his children must be punished, but can be understood. Those who claim a heavenly warrant for the cruelty have been tainted by evil, and also constitute far more of a danger. In the city of Jerusalem, there is a special ward in the mental hospital for those who represent a special danger to themselves and others. These deluded patients are the sufferers from the Jerusalem syndrome. Police and security officers are trained to recognize them, though their mania is often concealed behind a mask of deceptively beatific calm. They have come to the holy city in order to announce themselves as the Messiah or Redeemer, or to proclaim the end of days. The connection between religious faith and mental disorder is, from the viewpoint of the tolerant and the multicultural, both very obvious and highly unmentionable. If someone murders his children and then says that God ordered him to do it, we might find him not guilty by reason of insanity, but he would be incarcerated nonetheless. If someone lives in a cave, claims to be seeing visions and experiencing prophetic dreams, we may leave him alone until he turns out to be planning, in a non-phantasmal way, the joy of suicide bombing. If someone announces himself to be God's anointed and begins stockpiling Kool-Aid and weapons and helping himself to the wives and daughters of his acolytes, we raise a bit more than a skeptical eyebrow. But if these things can be preached under the protection of an established religion, we are expected to take them at face value. All three monotheisms, just to take the most salient example, praise Abraham for being willing to hear voices, and then to take his son Isaac for a long and rather mad and gloomy walk. And then the caprice, by which his murderous hand is finally stayed, is written down as divine mercy. The relationship between physical health and mental health is now well understood to have a strong connection to the sexual function or dysfunction. Can it be a coincidence, then, that all religions claim the right to legislate in matters of sex? The principal way in which believers inflict pain on themselves, on each other, and on non-believers has always been their claim to monopoly in this sphere. Most religions, with the exception of the few cults that actually permit or encourage it, do not have to bother much with enforcing the taboo on incest. Like murder and theft, this is usually found to be abhorrent to humans without any further explanation. But merely to survey the history of sexual dread and proscription, as codified by religion, is to be met with a very disturbing connection between extreme prurience and extreme repression. Almost every sexual impulse has been made the occasion for prohibition, guilt, and shame. Manual sex, oral sex, anal sex, non-missionary position sex, to name it is to discover a fearsome ban upon it. Even in modern and hedonistic America, several states legally define sodomy as that which is not directed at face-to-face heterosexual procreation. This raises gigantic objections to the argument from design, whether we choose to call that design intelligent or not. Clearly, the human species is designed to experiment with sex. No less clearly, this fact is well known to the priesthoods. When Dr. Samuel Johnson had completed the first real dictionary of the English language, he was visited by a delegation of respectable old ladies who wished to congratulate him for not including any indecent words. His response, which was that he was interested to see that the ladies had been looking them up, contains almost all that needs to be said on this point. Orthodox Jews conduct congress by means of a hole in the sheet and subject their women to ritual baths to cleanse the stain of menstruation. Muslims subject adulterers to public lashings with a whip. Christians used to lick their lips while examining women for signs of witchcraft. I need not go on in this vein. Any reader of this book will know of a vivid example, or will simply guess my meaning. A consistent proof that religion is man-made and anthropomorphic can also be found in the fact that it is usually man-made in the sense of masculine as well. The holy book in the longest continuous use, the Talmud, commands the observant one to thank his maker every day that he was not born a woman. This raises again the insistent question. Who but a slave thanks his master for what his master has decided to do without bothering to consult him? The Old Testament, as Christians condescendingly call it, has woman cloned from man for his use and comfort. The New Testament has St. Paul expressing with fear and contempt for the female. Throughout all religious texts, there is a primitive fear that half the human race is simultaneously defiled and unclean, and yet is also a temptation to sin that it is impossible to resist. Perhaps this explains the hysterical cult of virginity and of a virgin, and the dread of the female form and of female reproductive functions. And there may be someone who can explain the sexual and other cruelties of the religious without any reference to the obsession with celibacy, but that someone will not be me. I simply laugh when I read the Quran with its endless prohibitions on sex and its corrupt promise of infinite debauchery in the life to come. It's like seeing through the let's pretend of a child, but without the indulgence that comes from watching the innocent at play. The homicidal lunatics, rehearsing to be genocidal lunatics, of 9/11 were perhaps tempted by virgins, but it is far more revolting to contemplate that, like so many of their fellow jihadists, they were virgins. Like monks of old, the fanatics are taken early from their families, taught to despise their mothers and sisters, and come to adulthood without ever having had a normal conversation, let alone a normal relationship with a woman. This is disease by definition. Christianity is too repressed to offer sex in paradise. Indeed, it has never been able to evolve attempting heaven at all. but it has been lavish in its promise of sadistic and everlasting punishment for sexual backsliders, which is nearly as revealing in making the same point in a different way. A special subgenre of modern literature is the memoir of a man or woman who once underwent a religious education. The modern world is now sufficiently secular for some of these authors to attempt to be funny about what they underwent and what they were expected to believe. However, such books tend necessarily to be written by those with enough fortitude to have survived the experience. We have no way to quantify the damage done by telling tens of millions of children that masturbation will make them blind, or that impure thoughts will lead to an eternity of torment, or that members of other faiths, including members of their own families, will burn, or that venereal disease will result from kisses. Nor can we hope to quantify the damage done by holy instructors, who rammed home these lies and accompanied them with floggings and rapes and public humiliations. Some of those who rest in unvisited tombs may have contributed to the good of the world, but those who preached hatred and fear and guilt, and who ruined innumerable childhoods, should have been thankful that the hell they preached was only one among their wicked falsifications, and that they were not sent to rot there. Violent, irrational, intolerant, allied to racism and tribalism and bigotry, invested in ignorance and hostile to free inquiry, contemptuous of women and coercive toward children, organized religion ought to have a great deal on its conscience. There is one more charge to be added to the bill of indictment. With a necessary part of its collective mind, religion looks forward to the destruction of the world. By this, I do not mean it looks forward in the purely eschatological sense of anticipating the end. I mean, rather, that it openly or covertly wishes that end to occur. Perhaps half aware that its unsupported arguments are not entirely persuasive, and perhaps uneasy about its own greedy accumulation of temporal power and wealth, religion has never ceased to proclaim the apocalypse and the day of judgment. This has been a constant trope ever since the first witch doctors and shamans learned to predict eclipses and to use their half-baked celestial knowledge to terrify the ignorant. It stretches from the epistles of St. Paul, who clearly thought and hoped that time was running out for humanity, through the deranged fantasies of the Book of Revelation, which were at least memorably written by the alleged St. John the Divine on the Greek island of Patmos, to the best-selling Pulp Fiction Left Behind series, which, ostensibly authored by Tim LaHaye and Jerry B. Jenkins, was apparently generated by the old expedient of letting two orangutans loose on a word processor. The blood continued to rise. Millions of birds flocked into the area and feasted on the remains, and the wine press was trampled outside the city, and blood came out of the wine press up to the horses' bridles for 1,600 furlongs. This is sheer manic relish, larded with half quotations. More reflectively, but hardly less regrettably, it can be found in Julia Ward Howe's Battle Hymn of the Republic, which dwells on the same wine press, and in Robert Oppenheimer's murmur as he watched the first nuclear detonation at Alamogordo, New Mexico, and heard himself quoting the Hindu epic, the Bhagavad Gita, "I am become death, the destroyer of worlds." One of the very many connections between religious belief and the sinister, spoiled, selfish childhood of our species is the repressed desire to see everything smashed up and ruined and brought to naught. This tantrum need is coupled with two other sorts of guilty joy, or, as the Germans say, Schadenfreude. First, one's own death is cancelled, or perhaps repaid or compensated, by the obliteration of all others. Second, it can always be egotistically hoped that one will be personally spared, gathered contentedly to the bosom of the mass exterminator, and from a safe place observe the sufferings of those less fortunate. Tertullian, one of the many church fathers who found it difficult to give a persuasive account of paradise, was perhaps clever in going for the lowest possible common denominator and promising that one of the most intense pleasures of the afterlife would be endless contemplation of the tortures of the damned. He spoke more truly than he knew in evoking the man-made character of faith. As in all cases, the findings of science are far more awe-inspiring than the rantings of the godly. The history of the cosmos begins, if we use the word time to mean anything at all, about 12 billion years ago. If we use the word time wrongly, we shall end up with the infantile computation of the celebrated Archbishop James Usher of Armagh, who calculated that the Earth alone, mind you, not the cosmos, had its birthday on Saturday, October 22nd, in 4004 BC, at 6 in the afternoon. This dating was endorsed by William Jennings Bryan, a former American Secretary of State and two-time Democratic presidential nominee, in courtroom testimony in the third decade of the 20th century. The true age of the Sun and its orbiting planets, one of them destined to harbour life and all the others doomed to lifelessness, is perhaps 4.5 billion years and subject to revision. This particular microscopic solar system most probably has at least that long again to run its fiery course. The life expectancy of our Sun is a solid 5 billion more years. However, mark your calendar, at around that point, it will emulate millions of other suns and explosively mutate into a swollen red giant, causing the Earth's oceans to boil and extinguishing all possibility of life in any form. No description by any prophet or visionary has even begun to picture the awful intensity and irrevocability of that moment. One has at least some pitiful self-centered reason not to fear undergoing it. On current projections, the biosphere will very probably have been destroyed by different and slower sorts of warming and heating in the meantime. As a species on Earth, according to many sanguine experts, we do not have many more eons ahead of us. With what contempt and suspicion, then, must one regard those who are not willing to wait, and who beguile themselves and terrify others, especially the children, as usual, with horrific visions of apocalypse, to be followed by stern judgment from the one who supposedly placed us in this inescapable dilemma to begin with? We may laugh now at the foam-flecked hell and damnation preachers who love to shrivel young souls with pornographic depictions of eternal torture. But this phenomenon has reappeared in a more troubling form with the holy alliance between the believers and what they can borrow or steal from the world of science. Here is Professor Pervez Hoodboy, a distinguished professor of nuclear and high-energy physics at the University of Islamabad in Pakistan, writing about the frightening mentality which prevails in his country, one of the world's first states to define its very nationality by religion. In a public debate on the eve of the Pakistani nuclear tests, the former chief of the Pakistani army, General Mirza Aslam Beg, said, "We can make a first strike, and a second and even a third." The prospect of nuclear war left him unmoved. "You can die crossing the street," he said, "or you could die in a nuclear war. You've got to die someday anyway." India and Pakistan are largely traditional societies where the fundamental belief structure demands disempowerment and surrender to larger forces. A fatalistic Hindu belief that the stars above determine our destiny, or the equivalent Muslim belief in kismet, certainly account for part of the problem. I shall not disagree with the very brave Professor Hoodboy, who helped alert us to the fact that there were several secret bin Laden supporters among the bureaucrats of the Pakistani nuclear program, and who also exposed the wild fanatics within that system who hoped to harness the power of the mythical jinns or desert devils for military purposes. In his world, the enemies are mainly Muslims and Hindus. But within the Judeo-Christian world also, there are those who like to fantasize about a final conflict and embellish the vision with mushroom-shaped clouds. It is a tragic and potentially lethal irony that those who most despise science and the method of free inquiry should have been able to pilfer from it and annex its sophisticated products to their sick dreams. The death wish, or something not unlike it, may be secretly present in all of us. At the turn of the year 1999 into 2000, many educated people talked and published infinite nonsense about a series of possible calamities and dramas. This was no better than primitive numerology. In fact, it was slightly worse, in that 2000 was only a number on Christian calendars, and even the stoutest defenders of the Bible story now admit that if Jesus was ever born, it wasn't until at least AD 4. The occasion was nothing more than an odometer for idiots who sought the cheap thrill of impending doom. But religion makes such impulses legitimate and claims the right to officiate at the end of life, just as it hopes to monopolize children at life's beginning. There can be no doubt that the cult of death and the insistence upon portents of the end proceed from a surreptitious desire to see it happen and to put an end to the anxiety and doubt that always threaten the hold of faith. When the earthquake hits, or the tsunami inundates, or the twin towers ignite, you can see and hear the secret satisfaction of the faithful. Gleefully they strike up. You see? This is what happens when you don't listen to us. With an unctuous smile, they offer a redemption that is not theirs to bestow, and when questioned, put on the menacing scowl that says, "Oh, so you reject our offer of paradise? Well,